General Duncan Reel 3. Could you give me any examples of the way armoured cars were being used at this time on the basis of civil disturbances with which you did become involved?
Yes, there weren't very many civil disturbances. From Junin, we were about, we used to be asked to go out to some point on a track in order to intercept a band of smugglers or a band of raiders or something like that. Really all over what I call the Northern Plain, down as far as the Jordan, and back again. But that really didn't amount to very much. It was a rather welcome interlude. You were going out for some purpose. We never caught anything, but at least the soldiers realized that they were there for a job. And really, the two armored car sections, the light car section at Sumac and my own at Junin, were out quite often on that sort of job. And then there was another rail section at Haifa. I said that the second rail section was in Jerusalem, but it wasn't. It was at Haifa when you first came to the company. And they had a certain number of quite minor routes where they were asked to go out and like sort of stand by road intersections and that sort of thing as a visible sign of the army's presence, usually in company with the infantry. There were the Jaffa riots, which took place in 2021, were considerably more serious.
What happened then?
I think this blew up over the immigration question, as far as I remember. But we were hauled out at very short notice. I always remember that because I had to go to a funeral. We had a very close liaison with the RAF in those days. 11th Squadron, I think it was, and a chap who'd been up staying with us dived the wings off a camel and went straight into the ground. And I remember going to his funeral and suddenly seeing, as I was walking through this cemetery, four Rolls armoured cars going like bats out of hell, with the other two officers who were senior to me in the section waving goodbye to me as I walked. When I got back, I collected the remainder of the men in the section and the tenders. We went down to Jaffa, where these riots had taken place. I always remember I had to sleep in a marble bench that night, and it was the hardest thing I ever slept on. We were down in Jaffa, actually, for about a month. It was interesting. The Navy were offshore, and as we had no lights on the cars, we got the Navy to shine their searchlights up in the clouds and on the local hillside. And actually did our night patrols by that reflected light. And this is the first example that I know of what was the phrase, artificial moonlight, which became a great cry during the last war. That was very rarely very successful. And it was rather fun because we used to go and see the Navy. The Navy came for rides in our cars and so on. And we were down in Jaffa for a little under a month. And our time in Jaffa coincided with the arrival of the ex-Black and Tans under Colonel Tudor, who came to Ludd, which was quite close. And they created no mean scene. The first thing they did was take a taxi into Jaffa and refused to pay the taxi driver because they said he was asking too much. They set fire to his taxi in the main square. And that really shocked both the civilians and the police and the army as well. They weren't accustomed to that sort of behaviour. And they really were a first-class nuisance. They really were. As fast as you establish any like reasonable relations with the civilians, it was upset by the Black and Tan, just out of sheer bloody-mindedness, really. No reason for it. But, however, it went on. And then after that, we'd finished the riots.
We haven't actually heard much about the riots. I'm interested in them. What kind of problems you had, how the cars were used?
Well, the usual one, and you come up against the problem that you always do with armoured vehicles, that if you're confronted with a crowd of rioting people, there is nothing that you can do except shoot or go away. And this is the fallacy. This is the real danger. This is what the Russians were up against when they went into Czechoslovakia, in Hungary. And if you get too big a crowd, there is literally nothing that you can do. It's a classic example. The classic example of the whole lot occurred in India years afterwards in Peshawar, where there were bad riots in, I think, 1928 or 29, I think. And there, a crowd surrounded an armored car, turned it on its side, pulled the crew out and killed them one by one. And really, the only way in which you can control a crowd is by the foot soldier, with his boots and his butt. You can patrol with an armored car, yes. You can cover great areas of country, and provided that you have means of getting your information back again, you can bring other people out to take the necessary action. But short of opening fire yourself, or crashing somebody else's car, which you can do with relative impunity.
Mm-hmm. Were you actually using the cars in the city of Jaffa?
Oh yes, we were. We were patrolling there continually, but there were enough infantry there, you see, to avoid any. You never got to the stage where two cars alone were responsible for holding up an Arab mob.
You were used in conjunction with infantry?
Well, you were used in conjunction with infantry, yes. But this is a very... rarely, in actual fact, the cars were used for continual patrolling outside the city. Reports of movements of any formed bodies of rioters or people moving in on the city in any way. It was very difficult to tell who they were. They might have been Jews, they might have been Arabs. You would usually tell the Jews, but it was a very confused situation, and the only thing that you could do was to keep fairly tight control with infantry patrols actually in the city itself, and to put a ring of mobile patrols, the armored cars, to warn you of any form body which might be moving in from north, south, or east. Mm.
Can you give me any examples of the kind of things that armored cars did effectively and the kind of things which demonstrated their limitations?
You're going a very, very long way back and a lot overlaid. No, I don't really know. Like, as I say, you did keep this ring outside the city under constant surveillance. And it was really virtually impossible for anything other than small bodies of men to go into to get into the city. Mm. We did a series of sort of snap patrols, stopping people on the way and searching for weapons, and that sort of thing. That was a very popular move for the soldiers because the backs of the cars got filled up with fresh picked Jaffa oranges, which was absolutely lovely. But outside that, no. I can remember demonstrating at a village, where the political officer had said that the village had been slightly bombed. We fired belts above it, below it, either side of it, into the hillside. Very impressive. Very good practice for the gunners. But no, outside that, and then after that, you would then let the civil officer go in and say, we'll see what happens. And... This is what you bring down on your heads unless you are a good boy. And of course the chatter of Vickers' guns range about 300 or 400 yards, very impressive.
It sounds as if their contribution...
Their contribution was a very, very small one. It always is, you see, until you can say to the chap, all right, you can fire and the limitation is off. Or you can fire in case of emergency. But you see, your real difficulty, if you get 20 chaps coming down the road, a little body of 20 chaps coming down the road, two here, two there, three there, can't do anything with the armored car to stop it. The only thing you can do is you can dismount some members of your crew and with sticks and form, if you like, a human barrier across the front of the car. Mm-hmm. But this again is coming back to the use of infantry. Back those soldiers up with the guns in the car. But it's a hell of a job. It's a hell of a decision to take to fire when they come at you with very small numbers. If they come in great numbers and very excited, you dismount your soldiers, you're jolly likely to lose your soldier. And then, of course, you fire, and then that really is a major crisis. Yes, in 1921, the Royal Air Force undertook to reconnoitre and mark a practical route from Palestine to Baghdad. They were going to send over a party in Crossley tenders equipped with wireless, with surveying instruments, mapping instruments and so on. And they thought they'd better have an escort, and they hired what was number one section of the 4th Armoured Car Company to provide the necessary protection. And two of the cars, one section, remained at Amman. Mine went to Azraq, which is an old Roman outpost. It was the most easterly outpost of the Roman Empire, and is an oasis. And three tenders were to go over with the crosses. Those tenders with a box body on, and two crutches, which you could mount a vicar's gun, free mounting. We learned an awful lot during that expedition, very largely due to the fact that the cars were very old. They were all 1914 model Roses, and they'd had a pretty tidy bashing. And of course, getting through the lava belt, there's a lava belt which runs down from Damascus, I think called the Haran, which is about 60, 70, 80 miles wide. Azraq, where I was on the near edge, and where we were, the lava was flat. You could drive a car practically any way you liked on it. But as you went further east, it became more and more boulder-like, and therefore harder for two-wheel drive cars to get through. However, they managed to get both the cars through. They got the crosses through as well. Very often rolls had to tow the crosses, which were grossly underpowered. And eventually they got over to Baghdad, where the chap who come from the Egyptian survey, delighted to point out to the member of the Iraqi survey, that the maps were wrong and that Baghdad was actually shown a mile and a half west of where it ought to be. What the repercussions of that were, I'd never heard. But we did learn a lot from handling these cars. I learned a lot more about the inside of a Rolls Royce, because just before the expedition started, one of the tenders broke a lay shaft in the gearbox, and I and my two crews, we had two RAF tenders, one a wireless tender and the other a charging engine. And the two armoured car crews took the gearbox out of one of my Rolls armours, put that into the tender, which went on, and left me with a completely useless Rolls Royce gearbox. Somebody threw me up a lay shaft. I complained bitterly on the wireless about the delay getting it in an aeroplane and threw a second one up. And I was then confronted with the problem of putting it in. We got it in and it worked. We drove the car home. And while I was there, we did a lot of machine gun practice. We still had lashings of ammunition and spare parts. But there wasn't really very much to do. It was really rather dreadful 2 months. It was extremely hot.
The machine gun practice, were you firing on the move?
Yes, on the move and stationary.
What kind of targets did you select for yourselves as moving fire?
Bushes, rocks, anything like. Occasionally we put up proper targets.
Could you hit anything?
Oh yes, Father. Oh yes. Oh yes, indeed. It's quite extraordinary. It's quite extraordinary how good you can get with a free gun if you've got enough ammunition to practice with. And the first belt you fire, you probably put most of it above. 10 feet above and 10 feet below the target. Time we'd finished, I had certainly four gunners who you would rely on to get onto a target range of 250 yards on the move, provided the going was reasonably level. And quite a number of to back them up were not as good. Shooting under those conditions, you see, is really rather like shooting with a shotgun. You're shooting with a completely free gun, where the gun is pivoted. The chap is really firing literally by instinct.
Mm.
Funny how some of them turned out to be much better than others. Not really, because it's the same thing. You put an ordinary shotgun into the hands of the boy. One will show natural aptitude and one won't.
You've mentioned already that you came into contact with a number of other branches of the service while you were in Palestine, and indeed you also came into contact with the RAF.
very much so, because this place Azraq was the most important staging point. They used to dump petrol there out of Handley Page bombers and the thing called Vickers Vivi, and the Bristol fighters used to refuel at Azraq before they flew over to Baghdad. And the same thing with the DH-9As. We got to know the pilots very well indeed, and were very fond of many of them. And what's a jolly sight more, we became quite expert at servicing aircraft, which is there was nothing else to do. They jolly well had to be serviced, and there was nobody else to do it except ourselves. A wireless mechanic of the RAF, the pilot and any passenger, and so we did it. It was very good training.
Was there any other scope for cooperation with the air arm?
No, none really, other than the fact that you supply our rations. Our rations were sent over by air. One of the things I always remember. What he craved for more than anything else was fresh meat. And fresh meat used to be put into one of the old 4-gallon petrol tins with the top chunked off, and was then thrown out from an aircraft at about 200 feet, travelling as slowly as it could, 70 miles an hour, 80 miles an hour. The only interesting thing, I was only thinking of it the other day, was that meat never survived more than 3 hours. I suppose it was the bruising of the fibres of the meat. It had to be eaten absolutely once. As far as exercises with the RAF, no, none, because they were much too busy. They were going through, they were really complete birds of passage from the Delta, the Alexandrian Delta, across to Baghdad.
Mm.
So that one couldn't really do any cooperation now. They were. I remember they were very helpful. We broke another bit on one of the tenders. They flew the bit down. We got it made down in Baghdad, down in Ludd Aerodrome, and that was brought up and bolted into place. Nothing particular about that.
What were your relations like with the other army regiments that you came into contact with?
On the whole, slightly limited. The Greys were in camp, were in the other end of Jenin with us. They were very good to us indeed, good and hospitable and kind. But we were a very, very small unit, you see. It amounted to two officers and 25 men, I think. Rather sort of shut in on our own. Mm. There were various Indian regiments round about, who one, again, you knew the chaps, and you met them out trying to shoot what there was to shoot, Chikor and Sandgrouse and that sort of thing.
I was prompted to ask that question because you stressed yourself the limited effectiveness of the armoured cars in Jaffa, for example, and I wondered whether that tended to confirm that this funny new regiment really wasn't much
trust,
use.
Yes. No, I don't think so. The one's relations with on subaltern level were always most happy. And in actual fact, as far as the commanding officers were concerned, they were extremely sensible and well advised and understood one's limitations. I mean, they were no more anxious to get themselves and our regiments involved in a major row because of something we'd done. We were ourselves involved.
How did you deal with problems of navigation in the desert?
Well, I can't really tell. Oh, yes, I can. The navigation as far as the journey across to Baghdad, which was the only long one, which we're concerned with, wasn't, I understand, very difficult. I wasn't there myself. As far as I was going out to Azraq, we were following a map which was incredibly inaccurate, but at least you knew roughly the direction you were going in. And we got out of the car and took a bearing by a prismatic compass and said to the driver, that's where you've got to make for. Then after that, it was a matter of adjusting yourself, more or less, on a very haphazard affair. If you were to the right of the track, you told the chap to keep a little left, two or three degrees left on the next leg, which you hoped would sort of bring you back more or less on course. One never really had very much trouble about that, and of course, as soon as I got to Azraq, and as soon as I got the second armored car mobile, I was perfectly all right because there was a certain number of landmarks by which I could always steer. As far as the boys going over to the far side, they were all right. There were some landing grounds had been marked out following the line of the oil pipe which went up to Alexandretta, what I remember in those days. Mm. When they were halfway across to Baghdad, they picked up the oil pipeline and the landing grounds. It was a merely a question of marking them and logging them down accurately in their places. Again, the survey chap.
Yes.
And of course, they had so many survey instruments and that sort of thing, and if they ever did look like getting lost, they had to get out and turn to the boffins and say, where are we? In actual fact, they did most of their navigation with an ordinary prismatic compass. And they found that you took an accurate bearing with a prismatic compass before you left, or before you embarked on a stage of travelling, let's put it like that. And then, as you went along, if you stood up in the car, the prismatic compass was quite accurate enough to confirm whether you were on course or off course within 5 degrees either side. And then after you've driven for a couple of hours, you got out and took another prismatic bearing. There was no difficulty about that, really.
Mm.
Egypt, you see, faced quite different problems. And there they developed the sun compass, which was started, it used to be an ordinary vertical spike, a nail, driven into the dashboard, and you stared by the shadow. And gradually, as people became aware of the problems, the movement of the sun, and the direction in which you were actually travelling, so you then got onto various kinds of dials, which cast the shadow in the right direction for, I think it's 20 minutes. You've got to take fresh bearing every 20 minutes.
What advantages did the sun compass have over the ordinary prismatic?
Oh, quicker. After all, with the prismatic compass, you've got to get out. You've got to take a bearing. You've got to find something on which you can tell your driver to steer. Whereas the sun compass, once set, casts a shadow, and you say to the driver, keep that shadow on this pointer.
Mm-hmm. Now, you returned to your regiment, the Black Watch, in June 1922.
That's right.
This was because?
Because the armoured car company, you see, had gone home. We handed over the task of policing Palestine to the RAF. And therefore there was no requirement for the armoured car company. We returned home, went to Bovington, were disbanded. And I was then posted back to Black Watch.
When you handed over to the RAF, was there any sort of formal handover? Did you give them the benefit of your experience, advice, help with their training or anything?
Oh, yes. We told them what we could. It was difficult to to condensed experience, because of course it hadn't been written down. The RAF, you see, arrived on a very different. They'd had courses at Rolls Royce, and they'd had courses at their own armament school and gunnery schools and that sort of thing. They were in infinitely better shape than we were when we started. There is one thing which is frightfully important, although I didn't know it at the time, and that is that two groups were formed, one in Iraq and one in Palestine and Egypt. One in Palestine and Egypt, owing to the mentality of group commander, never did anything at all, except tidy up some things and get some more and better quality officers out. The one in Iraq, which was under the command of George Lindsay, did an enormous amount. They used wireless extensively, which I think they borrowed from the RAF or scrounged from somewhere or got from the army signals, something like that. And they also did a great deal of really close cooperation with the RAF. Mm. Not only in operation, but also in supply.
Yes. Let's concentrate on your experiences, mm-hmm. which you can talk about from first hand. One thing that does interest me is whether it went against the grain a bit to hand over your armoured cars to the RAF, of all people. I mean, had it been another army regiment, it would have been one thing.
It was a bitter blow. Why the hell should the RAF take this over? We're doing perfectly well. And the trouble was that nobody explained it to us. There was a complete lack of communication. And we heard that Winston Churchill had come out to Jerusalem, had been in Jerusalem, nobody had seen him. And it was a result of that. Why he came out, I don't know. Whether he was, I think he was colonial secretary at the time, and of course the Palestine and Iraq were under his supervision at that time. Anyhow, he'd been sold out, I think, by Trenchard.
Mm.
But it was a very good thing for the RAF. It kept them good and busy, and it stopped a lot of chaps being turned off. And the army weren't desperately anxious about to keep the armoured cars, which they didn't really understand and weren't making much provision about.
What sort of esteem did you find yourself held in when you returned to the Black Watch after some 2 years with the tank corps?
Oh, I've never even thought about this. I came back to friends who I'd last seen going out to Germany, who seemed pleased to see me, just rather like that. My company commander received me in a traditional way, cursed me for being me, but nobody mentioned anything about the tank. People said to me, did you enjoy it? What was Palestine like? That sort of thing. No, it made no difference at all. The fact that to put it another way, I hadn't lost caste by going to the Royal, by going to the tank corps, quite definitely. And bits of the Black Watch I enjoyed very much indeed, but I was bored stiff, quite frankly.
Mm.
After all, 6 months beforehand, somebody had drawn a line across Palestine, east and west, and the whole of the northern part of that. I had four Rolls-Royce armoured cars, I had men who I knew and trusted, and three tenders, and I could go exactly where I liked and do what I wanted, where I wanted. And I came back again to do an hour and a half, 2 hours work in the morning on a barrack square and go on a Carter course.
Seemed pretty flat.
Oh, that's a ditch boy. I had a platoon of 57 men, never saw more than three of them. I went on a Carter course. That in actual fact was the actual money for road rope, because all the stuff that we'd been doing naturally in Palestine, I was being retaught on the Carter course.
You absorb
that nice difficulty.
At this stage in 1922, as far as you were aware, what prospects were there for your getting back to the tank corps? As far as you knew at that time?
Well, Well, there were none. The only thing was I did have a highly placed contact in the War Office who didn't know me personally. But I knew his brother, who was a parson who looked after the United Boy. And as far as possible, I didn't assess the thing at all. The only thing I knew was that I was bored with Borden and bored with infantry work. The interesting thing is, you see, in those days you didn't work out prospects. I mean, really, not in the way that the modern youth calculates that I'm going to do so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. Life, I think, was the ordinary subaltern officer never bothered about his prospects. He either accepted fate as it was, or else he did what he could to bend it to suit his own convenience.
Yes, when I said prospects, what I really meant was...
Chances
of being able to get back. Oh, what were they at that time?
Oh, I didn't know. I hadn't faced that out. The whole of the War Office and the whole of the higher military hierarchy, complete sealed book to me in those days. After all, I was almost the lowest form of officer life. People did... It was possible that fate might turn out the way you wanted it.